I think this is probably a point at which we can open things up to the floor. If Lisa, yep. Do you want to take the mic, or will I run around?
Look, it's a very strange thing. I went to Trinity, and then I went to do a master's at a place called the College of Europe. And the College of Europe is a university in Bruges, which is supposed to, it's kind of like a West Point for Eurocrats, supposed to train the next generation of bureaucrats. You know what happened to me? I just went to the, I took too much acid or something. I don't know, whatever. But no, but it was, at the time I was very intrigued by it because I was really a big supporter. But as a supporter, I've now rationalised it because I was from Dublin and it seemed really sophisticated. Foreigners seemed more kind of glamorous than us. And I was always, I'd meet people and I'd say, where are you from? Ah, I'm French, but my father is Swedish and my mother is Belgian. And I actually ended up being totally ethnocentric. I said, can I just meet somebody whose mum and dad are from the same country? It'd be really quite nice. You know? So I think that the reason I tell you this story is that there is an elite, there is a deracinated elite in Europe who are the products of the project, for whom European integration is the primary objective. And then there's the rest of us who kind of shrug our shoulders about these things. Every time there's a European election in the South, less and less people turn up. I'm sure nobody's going to turn up in a few years. You know, because nobody's interested. I mean, it's very hard to get out of bed for Europe, for this notion of Europe. It's very easy to get out of bed for France, or for Britain, or God knows, you know, in this neck of the woods, for whatever tribe, okay? You know, you can wake up and think about these things. So my sense is that the gelling agent of the European Union is threat. And when you take the threat away, the gelling agent becomes quite amorphous and opaque and not necessarily that convincing. So I think it'll kind of amble along for the want of a better alternative. I don't believe in the British constitution. The thing about it is, if you read the Daily Telegraph, you will always get Europe wrong. Because the Daily Telegraph is written by people who want this project to fail. And the Guardian is written by people who want the Daily Telegraph to fail. Okay, and therefore they will deploy the European Union at a certain stage in that armory of weaponry against the Daily Telegraph. So I always find the English press really funny on Europe. And I speak with somebody who lived there for years. It's kind of like a schoolboy fight between two spoiled people. I think it'll amble along, but it is increasingly losing its focus, and that's a big worry. Lisa, you have the...
Just something you said there about the threat to Europe being the gelling agent, the threat of yes. War or whatever. And it strikes me that, you know, what America's doing, stoking up issues in Ukraine, in my opinion. It was interesting that Obama came a couple of weeks later and made a speech in Europe about how Europeans need to worry about the threat of gas and oil and need to start thinking about fracking. And then about a month later, the head of NATO, well, recently, actually a few weeks ago, the head of NATO told us that fracking groups were actually being supported by Russia. And you start to see a pattern here somehow. Maybe the whole thing in Ukraine is actually just a big project to make sure Europe gels together in a sense. What do you think about that notion?
Well, it's interesting because I actually learned Russian many years ago. I lived in Russia and I had this mad notion to learn Russian in 1990. I went there for about 4 months, and that's why I ended up working in these emerging markets, because I could read the Cyrillic alphabet like nobody else could. They said, Jesus, that paddy there, you can read this really alphabet. So I take an interest in these things, maybe over and above other people. Look, when I see what happened in the Ukraine, I was very intrigued. Being in Fermanagh today, I was thinking about the Ukraine, where John and I had driven past this morning in our BBC Ulster interview, and John said, oh, that's where the G8 were. And I obviously won't be the G8 for very long because Russia's been kicked out. And I thought to myself, as an Irishman, and this is not a political point, but it was an observation I made, but I didn't tell you, I just kept it to myself. I thought it was quite ironic. Here I was in Fermanagh, and a country in the G8 was going to be kicked out and punished for dividing up the country on ethnic lines. and drawing lines in the sand and saying Crimea are all Russian, so they're part of us. And I was going to say that to you, but I decided I wouldn't. So it's kind of funny how morality goes, isn't it? You know, the Russians are really wrong to do that sort of carving up countries and borders and counties and provinces, but everyone else is kosher with it. I suppose it's a matter of the time you do it and how strong you are when you do it. But I think the European Union, the Ukraine, is a great example of the European Union without focus. So we will support some bunch of lads throwing a few rocks in the square there in Kiev, and then we wake up one morning and say, fucking hell, they won.
Yeah.
What do we do now? That wasn't supposed to happen. They were supposed to just be a thorn in the side of the Russians, and we could lecture the Russians and be unpleasant to the Russians. But these dudes weren't supposed to. When you're Man Yanukovych, you know, you weren't supposed to shoot 100 people. That wasn't on the thing, right? So I think that what you see in Ukraine is an example of the European Union without focus. You also see a European Union without any cognizance of the consequences of what they're doing. I believe Russia had no choice but to do what it did to take Crimea back. I believe that the Russians will do what the Serbs did in Bosnia. And again, to use that word, they will outsource violence to the militia. And they will destabilize Ukraine indefinitely. And this is part of a plan to really get back at the West via the poor old Ukrainians. On the other hand, the Ukrainians are going to make sure that the IMF give them loans to pay Gazprom, the Russian company. And the Ukrainians themselves have behaved pretty badly too in the whole thing. So my sense is that what you are seeing with the United States, and I'm a big supporter of Americans, I've lived in many countries, and believe me, I'd much prefer to be run by Americans than Russians, and or Americans than Chinese. Now that's a no-brainer, right? For all their problems, the Yanks are broadly similar to ourselves, and I believe that they're not, in the overall scheme of things, they haven't been a bad superpower, but they are making some elementary mistakes right now. And I suppose their problem is that after Iraq, the United States doesn't have the stomach for an adventure anywhere. They don't have the resources, they don't have the stomach for it. They have a leader that understands that, you know, putting boots on the ground is a pretty stupid idea. And it strikes me that 25 years after the wall came down, it shouldn't be surprising that Russia is reasserting itself at all. Yeah, gentlemen there.
Hi, what's your prognosis for the economic health of an independent Scotland?
Oh, that's a good one.
That's a great one. On the basis that my surname is McWilliams, which is not particularly that popular in the south of Dublin, and my grandparents are Scottish, and I have cousins over there, dire fuckers, frankly, but they're over there anyway. And they are mean, it's amazing. But we went to a family reunion to Oost, and it was shocking. All the paddies were just buying everything. And the Scots, I was really, really shocked. We were really shocked by it after a while. So last week, my wife and I put on a book festival in Dalkey every June, and we had this discussion on the implications for Ireland of Scottish independence. I think Scotland would be a thoroughly functioning independent country. My only problem is I don't understand why they want to keep sterling. It seems to me very bizarre how you'd want to go independent and keep the currency of the occupier. And there is a great example of that, which is Ireland, which went independent in 1979, but only got, or 1922, but only got rid of sterling in 1979. I think it was kind of a sort of case of, just in case you made a mistake, I might give it back to them. We've run in Essen, but it was just, we just had a few gargles that night, and all went a bit pear-shaped. It was a good idea in the pub. I think Scotland, of course, can be, there is an extraordinary virtue in being able to screw up for yourself. Right? So the narrative now, if you look at it from London, is, oh my good God, you Scots, you're going to, you know, screw up. Well, so what? That's actually life. You know, that's how you learn. You learn through your failures. So the idea that Scotland should not go independent because it might make mistakes, the very reason you go independent is to make mistakes. They're your mistakes. That's the first thing. The second thing is, Scottish economy now is a pretty rich place. In global terms, it's a very wealthy place, and in European terms, it's quite rich too. And I've no reason that they wouldn't adopt beggar my neighbour policies like the Irish with respect to multinationals, with respect to using and abusing their tax system, with respect to attracting in foreign investment. So to answer your question, I think Scotland is a perfectly viable economic entity. I'm about to go on holidays to Croatia, you know, which is not a viable economic entity, but the right to make your own mistakes is almost a psychological right. And if you don't mind me saying so, sometimes when I'm in the north and I listen to the economic debate, what is tragic is you've so little power over yourself. You know, to make your own mistakes is a good thing. And we, you know, we were just talking about the small amount of things Northern Ireland can do for itself. So if they are go independent, keep Stirling, though, they have a problem. Because that ties you, like, it's an umbilical cord to London. And we know that London is not England. We know that London is its own beast and whatever the hell it is, a megalopolis. So I would suspect if the Scots go independent, they should go on their own with their own currency. If they do that, they'll be fine.
I think we're going to take a round of three questions, aren't we, Mo?
My question's about boom and bust. I mean, you talked a lot there and you say there's no end to boom and bust. But what we've seen is, like, the rich get richer and the poor sort of either stay poor or get poorer. That's not a very healthy outlook for anybody to be who's got kids at the moment to be thinking about how do we change the boom bust cycle so it's more equitable?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because my fear is that we're moving into an era where we're going to have more booms and more busts, more frequent and less far apart. And the reason is that it's for ideological reasons. Like, normally, what happens in the last 5 years, the reaction to this crisis has been we've got to cut social expenditure and government expenditure. All those things have actually equaled things out. And we put the entire burden of the adjustment and the solution onto monetary policy, i.e. lowering interest rates and pushing credit, which looks free, into the economy. And the way I look at this, could you imagine like having a fire hose, okay? And then you tie onto it a little garden hose. And then you tie onto a little pen, a solar pen onto the top, right? So you open the fire hose here, but you're trying to spray water all over the garden. But because you're depending on very, very dysfunctional banks to be the mechanism through which the water gets to the garden, it eventually is like a big fire hose of money, which goes through a little garden hose, and then goes through a pen, and then just eventually drips into the garden. And it always strikes me as a bizarre way of doing things. Unless, of course, you realise that somebody benefits from this. And the people who benefit are the already rich. So, because they own stocks. Most people, the idea that you can equitably drive an economy by driving up the stock market, and then that leads to people who own stocks spending a wee bit more, and that trickles down to Joe Soap, is nonsense. You know, most people's income is their wage. They don't have wealth. And people who own stocks are rich. And it does strike me that your conclusion is right, that we're going through a period where we're going to have more booms and busts. Unless, of course, the pendulum swings politically to the left, which it could quite easily. I'm always intrigued at how little we entertain shocks in the future. Like, for example, could you imagine if we were sitting here, what day is today? 27th of June. Imagine we were sitting here on the 27th of June 100 years ago, 1914, and I said, you know, tomorrow, little bloke from Serbia called Gabriela Princip, you might know him, but he's a little dude, he's pretty heavy with a gun, right? He's going to shoot an Austrian dude in a small little place that you don't know much about, and your brother is going to end up being killed in the Somme, which is a place you've never heard of in France, fighting Germany, who are your biggest trading partner. And 4 years after that, Ireland is going to be independent, even though we will have fought 250,000 for the Brits in the war. And the Irish Independence Party, the Home Rule Party, which is the dominant party of nationalist Ireland, will be eliminated. And you say, okay, that sounds really weird. To be eliminated by what? Because at the time there's going to be a civil war between the unionists and ourselves, right? But it won't be eliminated by people who are British, but it'll be eliminated by people who are actually think they're more Irish than the Irish nationalists. Sinn Féin. You'd say, just take him out, give him a drink, and take him out, right? And you said, and do you know what's going to happen then? The Russian Empire that you knew all about, that's going to go and it'll be taken over by a little sect called communists, a fellow with a beard, okay? You might have seen him around, knocking around. He's dead now, but he's buried somewhere. And the Austrian-Hungarian Empire is going to split into 7 countries, even though it's been around. And the Ottomans, remember those dudes who've been running the Cape down there for 500 years? They're going to be gone too. All these things happened because people allowed all sorts of things to move and checked. So I think that what we've got to do as humans is entertain that mad things happen, you know? And what is the status quo now can look very, very stupid in a couple of years' time. And if we allow inequality to keep going, who knows what's going to happen?
I want to take you back to the European question.
Yes.
Jean-Claude Juncker has previously stated that he wants to see member states directly electing their own European commissioner. Is that something you think is a good idea in Ireland, or should it be simply up to the government to appoint a current or past minister to be a commissioner?
I think it's a really bizarre idea, right? Because if you think about what the European Commission does, the European Commission is the civil servants of Europe. It really should be supranational. And by that I mean you should be going towards a situation where the person is not that representative of any one country. I think what you're seeing in Juncker is, to answer this gentleman's question and your question, you're seeing a fragmentation of the logic of Europe. And what you're seeing is going back to individual country-specific ideas. So the way Juncker wants to address the democratic deficit is to allow us to vote for the commissioner. With the commissioner then goes into the bureaucracy, and if the commissioner decides it's going to go into the bureaucracy and represent Ireland first and the European Union second, which I assume he would do, or she would do, then you get a fragmentation of the overall idea, which is that we're all the same. So I think the inconsistency at the top of Europe is, as I said, nobody really cares about Europe. They care about power in their own countries. I suspect the reason Juncker is coming up with this is in response to Cameron's unusual campaign. I mean, the Israelis used to say of the Palestinians, they never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity, which is a really nasty way of describing a dilemma. But the Brits never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity in Europe. I mean, here you've got Cameron's going to be isolated again today, I presume. Go home. Lafarge will sit in the fox's head or wherever he drinks and say, I tell you so. And the Brits are in hiding. So I think Juncker's trying to address Cameron, who's trying to address Lafarge. None of them really are talking about the big idea, the European idea. That's my own sense.
Yeah. We've got a few more questions. Can I ask one?
No. It's your gig. It's my party. I don't want to.
Corporation tax. Corporation tax is, it's been talked about. It's basically the only economic solution that's been talked about in the Northern Ireland media for the last 5-6 years. The people who are proponents of it say it's not a silver bullet, but they act like it is. And they say that, with all the austerity measures and the Troika, it's the one thing the Republic of Ireland held on to because it meant so much to them. Is that true?
It's certainly how we marketed the whole thing. Look, we know that multinationals say they pay 12% tax in Ireland, but in effect they pay 2%. Last year, the American Bureau of Economic Statistics reported, this is not a spin, this is what they put in their annual report, that multinational corporations based in Ireland, American multinationals, earned $980,000 per employee profit last year, and they paid $22,000 in tax per employee. So you can see the benefit they're getting is huge by being in Ireland. It is a big deal because it's a marketing tool for the Republic. The multinationals have created over 100,000 jobs, which in a Ireland, or in a country which has a labour force of 1.6 million, isn't a huge amount, but the jobs are good and they pay well. The terms and conditions of multinationals are usually much better than Irish companies. So I think it's if you're going to play the game, you might as well play the game. And the reason Ireland could have such generous multinational terms at the beginning is we didn't have any capital. So if you've no capital, you've got to make it cheap, and the way you make it cheap is you don't tax it. But I do think the world is turning, and I think the United States is very, very fed up with countries like Ireland. I think the European Commission is fed up. And it's a fine line between being a clever tax country and between being a rogue state in a world that wants to tax corporations more. And I think we in Ireland should be worried about that, but we're not, because what happens in Ireland all the time is we worry when it's too late. And then, you know, when the Americans say you're a rogue state and blah, blah, blah. I mean, I don't know if you know, Apple's been in front of the Senate in the United States at the moment, and they're going through their books, and it looks like Ireland is facilitating tax evasion on a monumental scale. With respect to the North, look, you can't compete with us if you don't have the tax corporation. It's really simple. You know, you can't compete. You know, you've got to go up to those people in Stormont and say, listen, this is a really no-brainer, right? The only way you can compete is if you subsidise everything else, which you do, right? You know, so Northern Ireland says, oh, we have 30% tax and la, 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 and then you subsidise everything else to level the playing field. You know, I'm always intrigued by the North because, you know, if you look back 120 years here, this was the Silicon Valley of the world. You know, this part of Ireland was the Silicon Valley of the world. You have huge manufacturing, huge technology, huge innovation, everything. It's amazing when you think about it. And there is an industrial culture in the North which didn't exist in the South. I remember when I first went to East Belfast, I was expecting to hear fellas roaring No Surrender and Landbag drums. That's what I used to. But actually what I heard was the whir of machines in fellas' back gardens. Do you know, in East Belfast, everyone's got a shed in the back. They make stuff, right? I even talked to Victor and he makes a bike and stuff. So this is my own family experience of East Belfast. Things are really, you know, I've made a plane out of a lawnmower or something. And you have an industrial culture here, which there's no way the North can compete without 12% tax rate. And anybody who says any different is spoofing you. So just do it. I don't understand why anyone in Northern Ireland is against this. It's a complete free, it's one of the very few free lunches you're going to get. And I presume it's just the Treasury in the UK, or they think
the Treasury have never really liked it.
Because they think the Scots will. Sure, the Scots will go anyway. I mean, even if the Scots don't go independent, they're going to get, the Brits are going to do unnatural acts to keep them happy, you know. It'll be like a scene from Train Spotting, you know. Anyway, you got the best heroine, you got the whole thing, just have it all. So I would think, yes, go for it. You have to go for it.
Just one thing I would say on it is that I'm afraid you're going to hear a lot more about this debate in the next few months, whether you like it or not, certainly on the BBC. And some of it is going to be almost indescribably boring technical detail. Because you've got to understand the way in the Republic, the way the system works, is basically like a big machine for sucking in money from multinationals, shaking off as much of the tax as possible and spitting it back out to the productive bits of that company. And they don't just do that through the headline rate. It's through things like, it's very boring things like thin capitalisation and tax-free foreign dividends and foreign controlled companies and transfer pricing. All these boring technical bits which surround the headline rate. We will get the headline rate, but we won't be able to adjust the other bits because the Treasury won't allow us, because it will completely undermine the UK tax base. So we just have to be very clear that although it will give us a great marketing tool to compete with the Republic, although it will allow us to compete with the Republic to a large extent, it won't be an absolutely level playing field under any circumstance.
Okay. Can I just have one thing? You know, the interesting thing is we're actually in this together. What I find about these discussions about Ireland, North and South, right? It's ludicrous. It's, you know, from an economist's perspective, it's a total joke. We are in this together, right? Whether we like it or not, whether it pisses you off or whether it's... The reality is this is a small island. We have a chance to promote ourselves together. We have exactly the same social problems. Okay, we have a large, redundant working class that hasn't worked for a generation. We have huge problems of public finances that we have aspirations, but we don't have the means. We are all competing with India. We are all competing with China. We all have these dilemmas. What I always find amazing in Ireland is how we've... It's what Freud called the narcissism of small differences, right? And I remember bringing a friend of mine, an Italian girl, to not that long ago, to Belfast and Dublin. And at the end, she said, "But you all look the same. And you all sound the same. You support the same things. You listen to the same music." This... You know, Freud, this is the narcissism, the outsized narcissism of small differences. We are no different at all. And the economy should be a leveller. And we should jump together on these things, to quote, I believe, a man with a beard. Didn't he say that once or twice? And was it Trimble who said jump together? My God almighty.
Yeah, he has got a beard now, though.
Whatever happened to David Trimble?
He grew a beard.
Did he grow a beard? Oh, he's very trendy then. Not talking about peak beard. Yeah. You know, beards are gone. Beards are not funky anymore. So, I mean, I've always think so. So the idea that, you know, can you imagine anything as ludicrous as if you put a factory in Leitrim, which is 4 miles away?
There's nothing wrong with that.
Okay. Think about it. You put a factory...
12, sorry, it's more than 4 miles.
It's not far away, though, right? Do you know what I mean? That you have to think about it. You have a different currency. You have a different tax rate, right? You have a different... It's ludicrous. It's really, really ludicrous, you know? And I always feel that too, when I'm up in Belfast all the time and I listen to conversations about difference, I say we're the same. And not only we say, but in economic terms, we could market ourselves the same. That's my point. So, for example, Northern Irish wages are at least 30% cheaper than Southern wages, right? So can you imagine doing something like this, saying, okay, you need the technology, you need this, that and the other, put that bit in the south, put the manufacturing bit in the north, it's for a foreigner, right? Where you can avail of much cheaper labour, much cheaper rents, much cheaper electricity. I mean, you've got everything going for you here, which is why we should never tell you this. It's better to have you scrapping amongst yourselves, right? But if I, you know, looking objectively, Northern Ireland has got the same level of education, much cheaper. Land prices, much cheaper. Rents are much cheaper. All your utilities are much, much cheaper, right? And as long as you keep scrapping, we benefit. You know, and I mean, it's as if, I always find it as if somebody from the Irish government goes up there and stokes up all this stuff and says, oh my God, they're just about to get on each other, fuck it, throw it.
I think we've got time for one last question.
I come from a small town north of here called Strabane, and machines used to were there in Simons and in the whole area, but it sort of seems to become a byword now for a dysfunctional town. It's partly geography, it's partly history, it's a lot of perception. What do small towns like Strabane and throughout Ireland, yeah, similar small towns, do to get ahead, get the jobs?
Yeah.
I think it's a really pertinent question, and I think it's probably an interesting place to end, because this always amazes me, driving through Ireland. So there's 20 Strabanes, 30 Strabanes, where there was some basis, there was some heart in the town, maybe employed 80 people, 90, 100, whatever it happened to be. And then you think, okay, is this just the way the world is? And it's not, because the United States is very interesting. In America, the story of America in the last 10 or 15 years in urban regeneration has been the revitalization of small towns. It's a really interesting thing. So the Americans spent, from the 1950s through to the 2000s, suburbanizing everything, the car, moving out, big sort of gated communities, all that sort of stuff, and allowing their small towns to dissipate. And now it's turned around. And what do they do? So what they're doing is, what you need is local people to take a risk, okay, on something. But what you find, like, for example, I'm from Dunleary, which is a really nice town, but it's a ghost town. And yet, it's right beside Dublin, so you have a huge amount of buildings which are unused, which people could live in quite happily. But if you think of small towns, I'm always intrigued. There's a company in Newry called, what's it called, something first?
First Derivatives.
First Derivatives, right? And I remember talking to the guy who ran it, and he said he always wanted to bring the company back to Newry. And I was thinking, okay, so you've got like a top-end financial company in Newry. And what the difference was one individual. The only interesting thing about Ireland is individuals really matter. People, like a very individual people really matter. In small countries, people matter more than systems and all that carry on. And when I look at something like that in Newry, you think, that was just this one guy decided to. So you do need one or two people locally to believe in the place and to try and put something there that attracts others. And then you have this virtuous circle. What is very clear is the state can't do it. It's very, very clear to me the state cannot revitalise small towns. The state will destroy it. And the reason is because you create a kind of a renting class that needs to actually get money every week for doing very little. And so, you know, in Ireland, the way things are, okay, well, what we'll do is we'll put the Department of Labour, boom, in a small town. And that will have 40 civil servants, and those civil servants. But what we found is that there hasn't been any real pass on from those jobs into the local economy. I don't really know why, but it hasn't worked. So the jobs remain those unique jobs, but there hasn't been any sort of flourishing. Whereas you find when people set up small businesses, that there's a much more dynamic cycle involved. And I really do. I mean, it's you take somewhere like Strabane. Strabane is, you know, when you're going across the Moy, is it? What's the river there? The river in Strabane, to Lifford. You know, it's a pretty part of the world, you know, and that part of Donegal is very, very pretty. So, I mean, there's no reason that small towns can't have small businesses, but it means that the people in the small towns have to have big minds, you know, really big ambitions, and that's a very hard thing to do. But the problem all over Ireland, you see that small towns are becoming ghost towns. And some places have a wee bit of tourism in the summer, but a lot of places don't. So you need to get small businesses going. And the state really can't do it. The state will destroy them.
That's what just occurs to me as we're sitting in Fermanagh, that do we know of any businessmen who suddenly built an empire out of not very much in a small town? I don't know, I'm lacking my brains, but certainly those individuals still exist in Ireland in some places. But I would just like to thank David McWilliams for a very enlightening talk. I hope you found it informative. I hope the kind of spur of punk economics has now infused you. So largely it's about asking questions and ignoring the models and realising that people are rational. I hope that as the dismal science, it wasn't too depressing. There was some cause for optimism at the end there. But ladies and gentlemen, David McWilliams.
Thank you.
Thank you.